Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin, and this is Meet the Writers. A good man is hard to find, but I have one here in the studio. He didn't start off as a man, and as his body's changed, he's explored the complexity of gender and examined how culture shapes our notions of masculinity. His first book was an award-winning memoir, Man Alive, and his second, Amateur, is about learning how to box in order to understand masculinity's tie to violence. He's a masculinity expert for Vice and has written several columns for various publications. A former senior editor at Quartz, his essays and reportage have appeared in the New York Times, Playboy and Glamour. He's taught courses at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism and worked as a television writer for the forthcoming Netflix show, Tales of the City. Thomas Page McVee, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks for having me.
It's so wonderful to have you here because your book, I have to tell you, was an absolute revelation to me. It's a book that I think should be mandatory reading for everyone and not just men. I think it really helped one understand.
Thank you. Yeah, that was the point.
Well, yeah, achieved very well. And we'll get onto how and why a little bit later. As we unpick some of the themes in the book. But two events really shaped your life. And I wonder if we could start off with you telling me a little bit about growing up a girl in Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I would say actually I grew up kind of in a weird way without gender because from when I was very young, I was, I guess, what you would call a tomboy. And I grew up with a mom who, in the 80s, was like a glass ceiling breaker herself.
She was a physicist.
Yes, yeah. She was a physicist, and she was, you know, I was raised basically by her. And so I think she sort of saw my gender as like an extension of, you know, in a feminist way, like kids can pick what they want to be, that sort of thing, which was a very forward-thinking way of thinking back then, though I didn't know that. I was a kid. So growing up, I felt actually like I had a very liberated sense of myself and my body, and occasionally, of course, like faced some backlash from peers or other adults or whatever in my life, but in my actual family environment really felt supported in who I was. And, you know, I eventually figured out at the time I thought I was gay. And so then had like that whole experience. So, but that was useful too, because then I was sort of embedded from a young age in a world of people who saw gender and sexuality as sort of more fluid and on a spectrum and that sort of thing. So I think I don't have a very typical story about my, you know, gender revelation, because I think I grew up always with an expansive idea of gender. It's just that kind of actually for me what was surprising was reaching a point where I realized, like, as much as I think of gender as something that can be so fluid and so dynamic, like, I had, you know, a real sense of dysphoria at some point in my body, like, later in my life, that just grew and grew to a point where I was like, I have to face the fact that I am, in fact, a man, which was kind of surprising to me, actually, because I really hadn't really thought of gender that way in such explicit terms, but it was true. And so then, since then, a great paradox of my life has been reckoning with the fact that I am, in fact, a man, and also I struggle with so much of what being a man means.
Well, you talk about a supportive family environment, but yeah, that wasn't always the case. You were
correct.
Horribly abused by your stepfather.
Yes, I guess within the context of gender, I felt was very supported. But in terms of like my early childhood, I was sexually abused by my stepfather, and he was my first sense of what masculinity was, you know, and my first model of that. So I think that's part of why I felt so resistant to my own gender identity as I got older. But that ended when I was around 9. So I think after that, when I'm speaking to being supported, I'm really speaking to after that point in my life.
There was another big event in your life, and yes, this is when you were attacked in Oakland.
Yeah, and so I spent my 20s in the San Francisco Bay Area. And to sort of tie this back in, like, throughout my 20s, it was when I was really beginning to think, like, maybe I am trans. Like, I was sort of exposed to trans people. I understood they existed. I had top surgery in my 20s, and I felt
top surgery means?
Oh, I'm sorry. I had, like, the surgery to reconstruct my chest to make it male-appearing. But I was really trying to be thoughtful about, I guess, my relationship to my body and just trying to let, you know, my body lead the way in terms of understanding myself and my gender. And so I hadn't transitioned sort of physically. I hadn't said I was a man. I just was trying to do what felt like immediately, viscerally important. So that happened in my late 20s, and I was clearly on a path of some sort, but I didn't know what it was yet. I'd spent a lot of time reckoning with this idea of my father and, like, feeling very aware that my ideas of masculinity were so sort of poisoned by him specifically, and that that might be part of my sense of myself. And then, like, when I was 29, I involved in a mugging where the guy who mugged me and my ex went on to target couples, straight couples, and shoot the men. And so that he targeted two other couples, and in both cases, he shot the men, and one man died. But what was wild about it was that it was before I transitioned, so he did, in fact, target me. It was a very long, drawn-out sort of experience where I was, like, execution-style on the ground with a gun to my head, and it was very upsetting and traumatizing. And I looked very masculine, as I always have, but I hadn't transitioned. And so I didn't speak for a long time because I was frozen. And when I did speak, he let us go. And it was kind of interesting because I feel like letting us go and letting us leave and sort of that sense of escaping, I really feel like I can trace back my whole transition to that moment, because that's when my sort of crossed wires around the way in which I felt growing up female. I wanted to stay in my body to prove my dad, you know, wrong or something. Mm-hmm. And I think realizing that, like, being let free because I wasn't a man actually opened up my worldview in a way and made me really, like, be honest with myself and realize that I was, in fact, a man, which I know is a little bit complex, but it's sort of how life works, I guess. It was a strangely spiritual awakening, and I transitioned the next year.
And as you were transitioning, I mean, you'd moved to a new town and everything. I mean, you had a lot of changes coming at you mm-hmm. at once.
Yeah, and what was kind of, I guess what really has shaped me as a writer, I've been a writer my whole life since I was 9 years old, and I wasn't really planning on being a person who was writing about gender explicitly, but, you know, sometimes material finds you. And when I started my transition, I had moved to Rhode Island in New England. It was kind of random that I was there, but I was there for a few years, and those were the, like, sort of formative years where I was having to, like, basically go through my adolescence again. And I didn't have a big community of people anymore around me in general, but certainly who were in the LGBTQ community. I didn't know any trans people there. Maybe I knew, like, one or two. So I had to find community in people who could relate to my experience. And those were almost all pregnant women, because it was, like, a time in my life when I was 30 and I was, you know, people I knew were getting pregnant. The people who were getting pregnant in my life were people who were going through hormonal changes, who were taking a big risk, and they weren't sure what was going to happen on the other side. They had to hope that what they were doing was right, but who knew? And so most of my connections around my transition were really women who were going through big changes themselves. But I think that taught me a lot about the capacity people had to connect to my experience, which was a human experience. I mean, trans people have always existed. So in that moment, and also in that moment in media, there was a lot of stories about trans people that were kind of problematic, much like today. So I really ended up feeling like I don't want to be sort of left out of the human family because I am who I am. And I think that, you know, my ability as a writer to write about this and to think about gender, you know, the fact that these pregnant women and I could talk about, I don't know, the weight of gender as part of our conversations about these experiences, it felt like there's a conversation to be had about gender that we're not having. Mm. And then as time went on, I got really interested in the global masculinity crisis, which was around that time, right immediately after the recession, was something that was something we were all talking about. And to me, there was a big disconnect between the sort of fundamental presumption that the global masculinity crisis was about work and men not getting access to work, because that wasn't looking at more deeply, like, why do men identify so strongly with having work be a key part of their identity? And for me, as a person who was being socialized as a man, as an adult, so much of what I was experiencing felt like it was being echoed in the conversations we were having about the masculinity crisis, but I wasn't the man that they were talking about. So hence my next project.
Well, Man Alive was your first book, a true story of violence, forgiveness, and becoming a man. It was published by Canongate. It's described as a memoir of both psychological and physical transformation, and you tell this story. Now, interestingly, you mentioned adolescence, and it does seem to me that yes, you're going through exactly what a teenage boy goes through, but with the wonderful cognitive ability of an adult.
Yeah, I keep thinking of it as, like, if I was a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old boy and facing the exact same things. I mean, my empathy for men is actually pretty big for this reason, because I feel like without frontal lobes, I don't know if I could make sense of so many of the things that felt problematic to me. And so much of the way we socialize boys is exactly how we end up with the men we end up with. So I think for me, much of what was dissonant or problematic about my experience or even the privileges I gained. You know, I wouldn't have been able to clock them as a child, like, obviously. So, yeah, exactly. It was a huge advantage, I think, to have frontal lobes while experiencing male socialization.
So, what makes a man?
Well, I think the biggest argument for fighting toxic masculinity, which is, of course, a socialized set of behaviors, not anything specific about men in general, but the way in which we socialize men, I think the biggest way to undermine that, and again, I guess when I say toxic masculinity, in case it's not super clear, I'm speaking of dominant behaviors, behaviors that teach boys that in order to be a man, you need to be able to dominate women, to dominate gay people, to dominate children, not show emotion, which has effects not only on, you know, the immediate people in our lives, and is tied to things like mass shootings, but also actually men are less likely to be stewards of the environment because they associate it with being feminine. I mean, there's all kinds of really dangerous effects of toxic masculinity. And the best way to fight that, according to sociologists I've spoken to and my own lived experience, is to expand notions of what masculinity even means. If you look up masculinity in the dictionary, it means like traits associated with being a man. It's like such a vague definition. So I think what makes a man, that's a hard question because we have the cultural ideas of what makes a man, which of course are also the idea that there's one monolith itself is wrong. But I think we have a monolithic understanding that we're all negotiating, and that monolithic understanding is pretty toxic. So expanding notions of what makes a man, I think, is the best first thing we can do, and expanding models of that for boys and for men in general, because the more those ideas get expanded, I think the more possibilities we have.
On a purely chemical level, of course, testosterone's enormously important, mm-hmm. and that's that you had to give yourself, I guess still do, daily testosterone injections.
Weekly, yeah.
And I wonder if testosterone is directly linked to violence, and I know that that's something that sparked your next project.
Yeah, it was my biggest fear, actually. So my next project, Amateur, it started because, so after I began reporting on the masculinity crisis, after I began seeing the ways that for me, when I left the house, you know, when I was home in my body, just enjoying my life, I loved, obviously, my new sense of myself in the world, and I was really happy, and I felt very sure that I made the right choice. But once I was navigating the world, once I left my apartment, there were so many ways that being a man in culture troubled me, like between the privileges I was gaining, which were very immediate and like incredibly fast, like within 6 months, because I was injecting this testosterone. So like the way in which like I could silence a meeting at work by just talking, for example, the way I was advancing so quickly at work, or the way that I could walk down a dark street at night when I had never been able to do that before. And not only that, but I was a threat to a woman who would be on the street, who would cross to avoid me, you know. So those privileges, I guess, and also the constrictions. Like, my mom died a few years after I began taking testosterone, and I felt very limited in my expression of grief. There was a very clear way that it would make people uncomfortable if I was talking about my feelings in a certain way. And grief is one of those things you can't really, or I don't feel like is healthy to like experience in a muted way, you know? But I felt very, like a lot of pressure to be a certain way in how I spoke about my own mom's death. And so that was kind of the turning point for me. And plus I've been reporting on the masculinity crisis for so many years, and I really understood the way we were talking about it, it just felt like we were making a lot of assumptions about what being a man was, even when talking about this crisis we were seeing around increased suicide rates, for example, and, you know, the left behinds and all of that. And so that summer in 2015, which was the summer after my mom died, I had this experience where for 3 months in a row, guys tried to street fight me. I was angry. I had grief, and I was walking around with grief, and I didn't have any other way to express it, and maybe I just was giving off a vibe. I don't know, but I was walking around, getting into these bizarre altercations, and the third one was the impetus for writing the book, because in that last fight, it was the closest I came to actually being in a fight. I really felt so frustrated and so constricted and so tired of being in the situation, and so mad, I guess, that I was like happy to be myself, but so unhappy with what it seemed to mean in the world. So that's when I decided, like, you know, I got into this altercation. I didn't get into a fight, but I did start to wonder, why do men fight? And that was the first question I asked that started this book. When I asked that question and I decided to start boxing, I decided that every question that came up related to my experience training, I was going to ask too, and also research. So testosterone was one of those questions. Like, does testosterone make men violent? I really wanted to know that. And what was really interesting to me was I sort of had to gear myself up to ask the question and to just, like, spoiler alert, like, answer it. The answer was no, actually. I talked to Robert Sapolsky, who's a neuroscientist at Stanford, and he told me that that's one of the biggest misconceptions about testosterone, that actually what it does do is it, there's no aggression receptors in the brain, he said, but what happens is it makes men seek status. And so they've run economic games where to win, you have to be really collaborative. And the men with the highest testosterone levels are the ones who win the games, even if it means being really collaborative and really cooperative with each other. But when they give men in those games, they give them a placebo and tell them it's testosterone, those men act like jerks in the games around cooperation. So, like, obviously, a lot of the way we think about aggression has to do with how we are encultured to believe that it's connected to testosterone. There's not actually a connection.
You decided to investigate this by learning to box yourself, and you sign up with a charity, Haymakers, and go off to train. You don't tell your coach that you're trans.
It seemed like a safety risk, first of all, to be announcing that. I mean, I don't know if you've been in a boxing gym, but it's a pretty, like, it's literally a subterranean place sometimes, most of the time, and I just wasn't sure what to expect around that. But also, more importantly, I didn't want my experience to be mediated by, I guess, the assumptions that the guys in the gym might have about me or what being trans meant. So it was really important to me, as someone who's always been out, I mean, unless I'm walking down the street, like, and, you know, you're anonymous in some way, I think most people in my life know this about me. And I was just curious about in what ways I might be treated differently. And I wanted to really report on that and sort of mark that. So I made a decision early on not to reveal my trans status in my training.
And there you are, catapulted really into the heart of masculinity.
Indeed.
What could be more male than a boxing gym? I wonder, how do you make yourself hit someone in the face?
It's a great question, because that was the hardest part for me. I mean, I was a goalkeeper in high school, so I felt pretty comfortable, actually, with the element of being hit. Like, that to me, I was used to being hit in the head. But I really struggled with the idea of hitting someone else who hadn't done anything to me. And it was a very visceral struggle. Like, I really didn't, it didn't feel natural to me. But what, over time, I've come to believe, actually, and genuinely, is that that is actually part of socialization, too. The ability to fight is really important. Like, we all have the ability to fight. It's an animal instinct. And so some of us are socialized toward that, and some of us are socialized away from it. And it's interesting to think about who gets to learn how to fight and who doesn't. So, not that I'm advocating violence in any way, but I do, you know, my thinking about this over time has really centered around, like, well, who is it that traditionally learns that fighting is okay and how to fight and how to sort of physically defend themselves, and who is it, what bodies in our cultures, you know, are taught not to fight, and that that's not something that we need to learn how to do. So it was hard, but once I learned how to do it, especially in, you know, in a consensual environment where that was the point and it was very actually supportive and encouraging and that was what we were all there for and it's a sport, eventually it got a lot easier. And I did come to think it was actually very important to know, if I ever have to know, that this is something I can do.
This book has wonderful insights from you personally, but it's also cross-referenced with a lot of great research. I mean, you quote many experts, many books that you've read about it. It's hugely informative. You write that you love being a man, but you don't love what being a man stands for.
Yeah. Well, that was the hard part.
Yeah.
And I really felt like, I don't know how familiar you are with the Jungian theory of the shadow, but, you know, his idea was that we reject the things that we aren't comfortable with as a culture and as individuals, that we reject those things and then they become a shadow and we drag them behind us. And then we're doomed to sort of act within that shadow and behave in those ways in a Jekyll and Hyde way unless we integrate them. And I really think as a culture, that's what masculinity has become in terms of toxic masculinity. And so we have these sort of, there's this idea of the good man and the bad man, which is in and of itself a binary that's problematic because, you know, for there to be good men, there have to be bad men. And also, if you're sitting around talking about what a good man you are, the chances that you're doing self-examination around, like, you know, the nuances of how you're not being such a good man, you know, even the moralizing of it is something I think is really troubling. So I think for me, once I transitioned and I was in my 30s and I'd gone through so much to have the body I wanted to have, I didn't want to then feel like I was constricted in a whole new set of ways around what I was supposed to be. I wanted to be able to be myself, and myself is a complicated person like anyone else. So for me, the book was a real desire to, like, explore those shadows and just face them and shine light on them. Mm-hmm. And I found as I was doing it that my shadows were everyone's shadows. Every sociologist, every historian, every biologist I was talking to, not only were they affirming these things I was experiencing and putting them in an academic context, but they were also, it's not in the book, but, like, they were telling me these stories that I largely thought of as off the record, but about their own boyhoods or their own experiences with their sons or their husbands. And, you know, this is a cultural, deeply entrenched issue that we're experiencing on a political level, on a, you know, social level, on an interpersonal level, and it's not something that has to be this way. And I think that's what, over time, I came to feel like, I'm glad I had this experience, and I'm glad I wrote about it, because I learned that there are a lot of like-minded people who really want to change the way that we're socializing our boys so that we can create a more expansive idea of what being a man means and hopefully save the planet and each other in the process.
Well, and you come to some great conclusions. I mean, just listening, for instance, yes. Not talking across women. I mean, you point out many things that men can do that just make them better people.
Yeah. One really important thing I learned was that, you know, the first rule of masculinity is don't talk about masculinity. It's like Fight Club. The second rule of masculinity is don't talk about masculinity. So, like, even asking literally a basic question, like, you know, why do men fight? Or once it got more real for me, you know, with the book, I committed to asking and answering every question I had. And some of those questions were really painful. Like, there was a point where I didn't want to fight this other boxer who was a woman to spar her. And she had way more training than me. She was very capable. Like, and it was something that my coach was encouraging. And once I realized that the real reason I didn't want, you know, obviously I didn't want to hit a woman, all of those things, but she was capable and it was not a situation where I, you know, we couldn't do this. And once I realized that the real reason was I didn't want to be witnessed by the guys in the gym in a sparring situation with a woman, because that would be sort of a comment on my masculinity, I had to deal with the very uncomfortable truth that I myself am sexist. And yeah. That was really hard. And so then I started looking at my sexism at work, monitoring how often I talked over women at work, or how often I was more responsive in email to men, just sort of all of these small ways that, or like I wasn't making the coffee, you know, like I wasn't doing the emotional labor of, all of these things were actually connected to my feminism and being socialized in a way that was about being assertive at work, but it didn't work in this body. And in fact, it was a detriment to the women around me. And I had to like really reorient myself. And so through that, I learned a lot of skills about stepping back, listening, getting feedback. Lots of things that we don't teach men are things that they're supposed to be doing. But in fact, for us to sort of uplift everyone, those are the exact things we need to be doing.
Mm. How have your relationships mutated? How do other men relate to you now who know your history? And how women relate to you changed?
Since I wrote the book or before?
Well, both really. But I mean, since you've been out in the world, since the world has known.
Yeah. I think before I wrote the book, a big part of why I wrote it was because I wanted to address the way those relationships had changed in a way that wasn't working for me. Like, I was touched less often, I noticed, for example. Or it was nice to have the automatic respect of men in every situation I was in, which I never had before. But also, it felt wrong to me. Like, why am I gaining this? It was sexist, and I was aware of it. So I wanted some tools and ways to have conversations with men about gender that weren't just about me being trans or about me getting an education, which I felt like a lot of the guys in my life were trying to sort of immediately induct me into, like, don't hug, only shake hands, like all these weird rules that I was like, why? Like, I don't want to do any of this. And with women, I wanted to be able to have my close friendships, as I've always had, without seeming like a creep, you know? And so I was wanting to look at, like, why those assumptions are being made and how can I be more of an ally to the women in my life in this body so we can maybe skip that part. And so I think since I've written it and I kind of understand the larger context of where everyone's coming from and the way we construct gender, my relationships have really become a lot more deep and fruitful, I think, across gender, because I think my interest has been in engaging people in a real, like, humane way around, like, these behaviors and also trying really hard, you know, with the women in my life, the cis women in my life, and trans women in my life, being really conscious as an ally of, like, what's going on for them, you know, like, in the Me Too movement, for example, in this moment, like, being a, you know, a believer, a supporter, like, someone who's outwardly speaking, you know, in agreement with, you know, the women around me, and just sort of, I'd say the number one change is I don't feel policed about my masculinity, which is, that is the way in which we keep men in a box around being men. So, you know, I, of course, like anyone who'd be talking about these topics, get a ton of hate mail and harassment, etc. But it's all about policing how real I am as a man, I feel immune to that, which is kind of a superpower, and I wish it for all men. I don't feel worried about what other men think of my masculinity. I think it's a pyramid scheme about being a man, you know, that, that men have to spend all this time and energy cannibalizing their own energy, policing each other, when in fact people who are in actual power are making a lot of decisions about all of our lives and we're too distracted to even notice it because we're, you know, in this constant, like, fight about who's the most masculine, and that is a waste of time. So maybe my biggest relationship changes have been around not caring about that, and thus I think being in a position to talk about it more freely. And I think a lot of men I talk to end up feeling more liberated themselves as a result of these conversations, it seems like, anyway.
Men that haven't had these conversations and perhaps haven't thought about these issues, and I am generalizing completely. I guess my question is, why do they hate us?
Why do they hate us?
Women.
Yes, why do they hate women? Well,
because I think many of them do. I mean, would you agree with that?
I think, yeah. And I think that, so what was really sad and touching and what sort of gives me hope in a way, but also makes me sad in a way, is that every question I asked for my book, because it really was questions that came up, almost every one of them led me back to boys. And once I really made a study of boys and boyhood and how we socialize boys, I learned the sort of collective way in which we are reproducing this kind of masculinity over and over again. So there's something called the man box. It's like a tool that sociologists use, and they go into classrooms with like usually like 10 to 12-year-old boys. You know, they draw a box on the board, and they say, okay, so what makes a man? Tell me what goes in this box. And that's when they put in these things like being dominant, being strong, not showing emotion, never crying, having a girlfriend. Sometimes they then are asked to like put things outside of the box that are like what not being a man means. And they're what Niobe Wei, the psychologist I talked to from NYU for my book, she calls everything that makes us human. So, you know, having empathy, like being emotional, being vulnerable, like all of those qualities don't fit into the man box for boys as young as 10 to 12. So if that's the way we train as a culture, because it is culture and it's an enculturated thing, if that's the way we train boys to believe that they are supposed to be as they get older, why are we surprised then that's what happens, you know? So why do they hate us? Because we teach boys that the only way to be men is to be dominant, and to be dominant over women and everyone else. And we also then collectively believe that there's such a thing as a real man, which is very strange when you think about it, because we don't really talk about real women, except for, you know, in the context of trans politics, which is problematic in a separate way. But you know, there's really like a bizarre idea that being a real man is a thing, but also that it's an unattainable moving target. And so men are constantly trying to prove through this man box how real they are. And a fundamental tenet of the man box is being dominant over women. So they hate us because, or they hate you, I guess, because like, although they seem to hate me too sometimes, because there's this idea that in order to be a man, you need to be the kind of person that rejects anything feminine, rejects anything gay, rejects anything trans, because any of those things are fundamentally opposed in this man box to what being a man means. But it's sad to me to think about those boys who, of course, have empathy, of course, have vulnerability. They have all of those things. They're children, that they've been socialized out of it and then just affirmed over and over again in this performance of being a man.
They need to read this book. Everybody needs to read this book.
Thank you.
The book, of course, is about your journey to Madison Square Garden. You became the first trans person to box there, although you didn't know that at the time, I think.
Yes.
And it's just a wonderful story alongside these very, very deep insights, which have been so valuable to me. So thank you,
Thank
Thomas.
You so much.
Amateur, a true story about what makes a man, is published by Canongate. It is by Thomas Page McBee. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans, Barbara Maimoni, Mariana Lagrasta, and Sarah Miles. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.